in a large chimney piece set round with pictured tiles, but now closed by an iron fireboard through which ran the funnel of a modern stove. There was a carpet on the floor, originally of rich texture, but so worn and faded in these latter years that its once brilliant figure had quite vanished into one indistinguishable hue. In the way of furniture, there were two tables, one constructed with perplexing intricacy and exhibiting as many feet as a centipede, the other more delicately wrought with four long and slender legs, so apparently frail that it was almost incredible what a length of time the ancient tea-table had stood upon them. Half a dozen chairs stood about the room, straight and stiff, and so ingeniously contrived for the discomfort of the human person that they were irksome even to sight and conveyed the ugliest possible idea of the state of society to which they could have been adapted. One exception there was, however, in a very antique elbow chair with a high back, carved elaborately in oak, and a roomy depth within its arms that made up by its spacious comprehensiveness for the lack of any of those artistic curves which abound in a modern chair. As for ornamental articles of furniture, we recollect but two, if such they may be called. One was a map of the Pynchon territory at the eastward, not engraved but the handiwork of some skilled old draftsman, and grotesquely illuminated with pictures of Indians and wild beasts, among which was seen a lion. The natural history of the region being as little known as its geography, which was put down most fantastically awry. The other adornment was the portrait of old Colonel Pynchon at two-thirds length, representing the stern features of a puritanic-looking personage, in a skullcap, with a laced band and a grisly beard, holding a Bible with one hand, and in the other uplifting an iron sword-hilt. The latter object, being more successfully depicted by the artist, stood out in far greater prominence than the sacred volume. Face to face with this picture, on entering the apartment, Miss Hepzibah Pynchon came to a pause, regarding it with a singular scowl, a strange contortion of the brow, which by people who did not know her would probably have been interpreted as an expression of bitter anger and ill-will, but it was no such thing. She, in fact, felt a reverence for the pictured visage, of which only a far-descended and time-stricken virgin could be susceptible, and this forbidding scowl was the innocent result of her near-sightedness, and an effort so to concentrate her powers of vision as to substitute a firm outline on the object instead of a vague one. We must linger a moment on this unfortunate expression of poor Hepzibah's brow. Her scowl, as the world or such part of it as sometimes caught a transitory glimpse of her at the window wickedly persisted in calling it, her scowl had done Miss Hepzibah a very ill office, in establishing her character as an ill-tempered old maid. Nor does it appear improbable that by often gazing at herself in a dim looking-glass and perpetually encountering her own frown within its ghostly sphere, she had been led to interpret the expression almost as unjustly as the world did. "How miserably cross I look," she must often have whispered to herself, and ultimately have fancied herself so by a sense of inevitable doom. But her heart never frowned. It was naturally tender, sensitive, and full of little tremors and palpitations, all of which weaknesses it retained, while her visage was growing so perversely stern and even fierce. Nor had Hepzibah ever any hardihood except what came from the very warmest nook in her affections. All this time, however, we are loitering faint-heartedly on the threshold of our story. In very truth, we have an invincible reluctance to disclose what Miss Hepzibah Pynchon was about to do. It has already been observed that in the basement story of the gable fronting on the street, an unworthy ancestor nearly a century ago had fitted up a shop. Ever since the old gentleman retired from trade and fell asleep under his coffin lid, not only the shop door but the inner arrangements had been suffered to remain unchanged, while the dust of ages gathered inch deep over the shelves and counter and partly filled an old pair of scales, as if it were of value enough to be weighed. It treasured itself up, too, in the half-open till, where there still lingered a base sixpence, worth neither more nor less than the hereditary pride which had here been put to shame. Such had been the state and condition of the little shop in old Hepzibah's childhood, when she and her brother used to play hide-and-seek in its forsaken precincts. So it had remained, until within a few days past. But now, though the shop window was still closely curtained from the public gaze, a remarkable change had taken place in its interior. The rich and heavy festoons of cobweb, which it had cost a long ancestral succession of spiders their life's labor to spin and weave, had been carefully brushed away from the ceiling. The counter, shelves, floor had all been scoured, and the latter was overstrewn with fresh blue sand. The brown scales, too, had evidently undergone rigid discipline in an unavailing effort to rub off the rust, which, alas, had eaten through and through their substance. Neither was the little old shop any longer empty of merchantable goods. A curious eye, privileged to take an account of stock and investigate behind the counter, would have discovered a barrel, yea, two or three barrels and half ditto, one containing flour, another apples, and a third perhaps Indian meal. There was likewise a square box of pine wood full of soap in bars, also another of the same size in which were tallow candles, 10 to the pound. A small stock of brown sugar, some white beans and split peas, and a few other commodities of low price, and such as are constantly in demand, made up the bulkier portion of the merchandise. It might have been taken for a ghostly or phantasmagoric reflection of the old shopkeeper Pynchon's shabbily provided shelves, save that some of the articles were of a description and outward form which could hardly have been known in his day. For instance, there was a glass pickle jar filled with fragments of Gibraltar rock, not indeed splinters of the veritable stone foundation of the famous fortress, but bits of delectable candy, neatly done up in white paper. Jim Crow, moreover, was seen executing his world-renowned dance in gingerbread. A party of leaden dragoons were galloping along one of the shelves in equipments and uniform of modern cut, and there were some sugar figures with no strong resemblance to the humanity of any epoch, but less unsatisfactorily representing our own fashions than those of 100 years ago. Another phenomenon, still more strikingly modern, was a package of Lucifer matches, which in old times would have been thought actually to borrow their instantaneous flame from the nether fires of Tophet. In short, to bring the matter at once to a point, it was incontrovertibly evident that somebody had taken the shop and fixtures of the long-retired and forgotten Mr. Pynchon, and was about to renew the enterprise of that departed worthy with a different set of customers. Who could this bold adventurer be? And of all places in the world, why had he chosen the House of the Seven Gables as the scene of his commercial speculations? We return to the elderly maiden. She at length withdrew her eyes from the dark countenance of the colonel's portrait, heaved a sigh, indeed her breast was a very cave of Aeolus that morning, and stepped across the room on tiptoe, as is the customary gait of elderly women. Passing through an intervening passage, she opened a door that communicated with the shop, just now so elaborately described. Owing to the projection of the upper story, and still more to the thick shadow of the Pynchon elm, which stood almost directly in front of the gable, the twilight here was still as much akin to night as morning. Another heavy sigh from Miss Hepzibah. After a moment's pause on the threshold, peering towards the window with her near-sighted scowl, as if frowning down some bitter enemy, she suddenly projected herself into the shop. The haste and, as it were, the galvanic impulse of the moment were really quite startling. Nervously, in a sort of frenzy, we almost say, she began to busy herself in arranging some children's playthings and other little wares on the shelves and at the shop window. In the aspect of this dark-arrayed, pale-faced, lady-like old figure, there was a deeply tragic character that contrasted irreconcilably with the ludicrous pettiness of her employment. It seemed a queer anomaly that so gaunt and dismal a personage should take a toy in hand. A miracle that the toy did not vanish in her grasp. A miserably absurd idea that she should go on perplexing her stiff and somber intellect with the question how to tempt little boys into her premises. Yet such is undoubtedly her object. Now she places a gingerbread elephant against the window, but with so tremulous a touch that it tumbles upon the floor with the dismemberment of three legs and its trunk. It has ceased to be an elephant and has become a few bits of musty gingerbread. There again she has upset a tumbler of marbles, all of which roll different ways, and each individual marble devil-directed into the most difficult obscurity that it can find. Heaven help our poor old Hepzibah, and forgive us for taking a ludicrous view of her position. As her rigid and rusty frame goes down upon its hands and knees in quest of the absconding marbles, we positively feel so much the more inclined to shed tears of sympathy, from the very fact that we must needs turn aside and laugh at her. For here, and if we fail to impress it suitably upon the reader, it is our own fault, not that of the theme, here is one of the truest points of melancholy interest that occur in ordinary life. It was the final throw of what called itself old gentility. A lady, who had fed herself from childhood with the shadowy food of aristocratic reminiscences, and whose religion it was that a lady's hand soils itself irremediably by doing aught for bread, this born lady, after 60 years of narrowing means, is fain to step down from her pedestal of imaginary rank. Poverty, treading closely at her heels for a lifetime, had come up with her at last. She must earn her own food or starve. And we have stolen upon Miss Hepzibah Pynchon too irreverently at the instant of time when the patrician lady is to be transformed into the plebeian woman. In this republican country, amid the fluctuating waves of our social life, somebody is always at the drowning point. The tragedy is enacted with as continual a repetition as that of a popular drama on a holiday, and nevertheless is felt as deeply, perhaps, as when an hereditary noble sinks below his order. More deeply, since with us rank is the grosser substance of wealth and a splendid establishment, and has no spiritual existence after the death of these, but dies hopelessly along with them. And therefore, since we have been unfortunate enough to introduce our heroine at so inauspicious a juncture, we would entreat for a mood of due solemnity in the spectators of her fate. Let us behold in poor Hepzibah the immemorial lady, 200 years old on this side of the water, and thrice as many on the other, with her antique portraits, pedigrees, coats of arms, records and traditions, and her claim as joint heiress to that princely territory at the eastward, no longer a wilderness but a populous fertility, born too in Pynchon Street under the Pynchon elm and in the Pynchon house where she has spent all her days, reduced now in that very house to be the huckstress of a scent shop. This business of setting up a petty shop is almost the only resource of women in circumstances at all similar to those of our unfortunate recluse. With her nearsightedness and those tremulous fingers of hers, at once inflexible and delicate, she could not be a seamstress. Although her sampler of 50 years gone by exhibited some of the most recondite specimens of ornamental needlework, a school for little children had been often in her thoughts, and at one time she had begun a review of her early studies in the New England Primer, with a view to prepare herself for the office of instructress. But the love of children had never been quickened in Hepzibah's heart, and was now torpid, if not extinct. She watched the little people of the neighborhood from her chamber window, and doubted whether she could tolerate a more intimate acquaintance with them. Besides, in our day, the very ABC has become a science, greatly too abstruse to be any longer taught by pointing a pin from letter to letter. A modern child could teach old Hepzibah more than old Hepzibah could teach the child. So, with many a cold, deep heartquake at the idea of at last coming into sordid contact with the world, from which she had so long kept aloof, while every added day of seclusion had rolled another stone against the cavern door of her hermitage, the poor thing bethought herself of the ancient shop window, the rusty scales and dusty till. She might have held back a little longer, but another circumstance not yet hinted at had somewhat hastened her decision. Her humble preparations, therefore, were duly made, and the enterprise was now to be commenced. Nor was she entitled to complain of any remarkable singularity in her fate, for in the town of her nativity we might point to several little shops of a similar description, some of them in houses as ancient as that of the Seven Gables, and one or two, it may be, where a decayed gentlewoman stands behind the counter as grim an image of family pride as Miss Hepzibah Pynchon herself. It was overpoweringly ridiculous, we must honestly confess it, the deportment of the maiden lady while setting her shop in order for the public eye. She stole on tiptoe to the window as cautiously as if she conceived some bloody-minded villain to be watching behind the elm tree, with intent to take her life. Stretching out her long, lank arm, she put a paper of pearl buttons, a jew's harp, or whatever the small article might be, in its destined place, and straightway vanished back into the dusk, as if the world need never hope for another glimpse of her. It might have been fancied, indeed, that she expected to minister to the wants of the community unseen, like a disembodied divinity or enchantress, holding forth her bargains to the reverential and awe-stricken purchaser in an invisible hand. But Hepzibah had no such flattering dream. She was well aware that she must ultimately come forward and stand revealed in her proper individuality. But, like other sensitive persons, she could not bear to be observed in the gradual process, and chose rather to flash forth on the world's astonished gaze at once. The inevitable moment was not much longer to be delayed. The sunshine might now be seen stealing down the front of the opposite house, from the windows of which came a reflected gleam struggling through the boughs of the elm tree and enlightening the interior of the shop more distinctly than heretofore. The town appeared to be waking up. A baker's cart had already rattled through the street, chasing away the latest vestige of night's sanctity with the jingle-jangle of its dissonant bells. A milkman was distributing the contents of his cans from door to door, and the harsh peal of a fisherman's conch shell was heard far off around the corner. None of these tokens escaped Hepzibah's notice. The moment had arrived. To delay longer would be only to lengthen out her misery. Nothing remained except to take down the bar from the shop door, leaving the entrance free. More than free, welcome, as if all were household friends to every passer-by whose eyes might be attracted by the commodities at the window. This last act Hepzibah now performed, letting the bar fall with what smote upon her excited nerves as a most astounding clatter. Then, as if the only barrier betwixt herself and the world had been thrown down and a flood of evil consequences would come tumbling through the gap, she fled into the inner parlor, threw herself into the ancestral elbow chair, and wept. Our miserable old Hepzibah! It is a heavy annoyance to a writer who endeavors to represent nature, its various attitudes and circumstances, in a reasonably correct outline and true coloring, that so much of the mean and ludicrous should be hopelessly mixed up with the purest pathos which life anywhere supplies to him. What tragic dignity, for example, can be wrought into a scene like this? How can we elevate our history of retribution for the sin of long ago, when, as one of our most prominent figures, we are compelled to introduce not a young and lovely woman, nor even the stately remains of beauty storm-shattered by affliction, but a gaunt, sallow, rusty-jointed maiden, in a long-waisted silk gown, and with the strange horror of a turban on her head. Her visage is not even ugly. It is redeemed from insignificance only by the contraction of her eyebrows into a near-sighted scowl. And, finally, her great life trial seems to be that after 60 years of idleness she finds it convenient to earn comfortable bread by setting up a shop in a small way. Nevertheless, if we look through all the heroic fortunes of mankind, we shall find this same entanglement of something mean and trivial with whatever is noblest in joy or sorrow. Life is made up of marble and mud. And, without all the deeper trust in a comprehensive sympathy above us, we might hence be led to suspect the insult of a sneer, as well as an immitigable frown on the iron countenance of fate. What is called poetic insight is the gift of discerning in this sphere of strangely mingled elements the beauty and the majesty which are compelled to assume a garb so sordid. 3. The First Customer. Miss Hepzibah Pynchon sat in the oaken elbow chair with her hands over her face, giving way to that heavy down-sinking of the heart which most persons have experienced, when the image of hope itself seems ponderously molded of lead on the eve of an enterprise at once doubtful and momentous. She was suddenly startled by the tinkling alarum, high, sharp, and irregular, of a little bell. The maiden lady arose upon her feet as pale as a ghost at cockcrow, for she was an enslaved spirit, and this the talisman to which she owed obedience. This little bell, to speak in plainer terms, being fastened over the shop door, was so contrived as to vibrate by means of a steel spring, and thus convey notice to the inner regions of the house when any customer should cross the threshold. Its ugly and spiteful little din, heard now, for the first time perhaps since Hepzibah's periwigged predecessor had retired from trade, at once set every nerve of her body in responsive and tumultuous vibration. The crisis was upon her. Her first customer was at the door. Without giving herself time for a second thought, she rushed into the shop, pale, wild, desperate in gesture and expression, scowling portentously, and looking far better qualified to do fierce battle with a housebreaker than to stand smiling behind the counter, bartering small wares for a copper recompense. Any ordinary customer, indeed, would have turned his back and fled. And yet there was nothing fierce in Hepzibah's poor old heart. Nor had she, at the moment, a single bitter thought against the world at large, or one individual man or woman. She wished them all well, but wished, too, that she herself were done with them and in her quiet grave. The applicant by this time stood within the doorway. Coming freshly, as he did, out of the morning light, he appeared to have brought some of its cheery influences into the shop along with him. It was a slender young man, not more than 21 years old, with rather a grave and thoughtful expression for his years, but likewise a springy alacrity and vigor. These qualities were not only perceptible physically in his make and motions, but made themselves felt almost immediately in his character. A brown beard, not too silken in its texture, fringed his chin, but as yet without completely hiding it. He wore a short mustache, too, and his dark, high-featured countenance looked all the better for these natural ornaments. As for his dress, it was of the simplest kind, a summer sack of cheap and ordinary material, thin checkered pantaloons, and a straw hat by no means of the finest braid. Oak Hall might have supplied his entire equipment. He was chiefly marked as a gentleman, if such indeed he made any claim to be, by the rather remarkable whiteness and nicety of his clean linen. He met the scowl of old Hepzibah without apparent alarm, as having heretofore encountered it and found it harmless. "So, my dear Miss Pynchon," said the daguerreotypist, for it was that sole other occupant of the seven-gabled mansion, "I am glad to see that you have not shrunk from your good purpose. I merely look in to offer my best wishes, and to ask if I can assist you any further in your preparations." People in difficulty and distress, or in any manner at odds with the world, can endure a vast amount of harsh treatment, and perhaps be only the stronger for it, whereas they give way at once before the simplest expression of what they perceive to be genuine sympathy. So it proved with poor Hepzibah. For when she saw the young man smile, looking so much the brighter on a thoughtful face, and heard his kindly tone, she broke first into a hysteric giggle, and then began to sob. "Ah, Mr. Holgrave," cried she, as soon as she could speak, "I never can go through with it, never, never, never. I wish I were dead, and in the old family tomb with all my forefathers, with my father and my mother and my sister, yes, and with my brother, who had far better find me there than here. The world is too chill and hard, and I am too old and too feeble and too hopeless. "Ah, believe me, Miss Hepzibah," said the young man quietly, "these feelings will not trouble you any longer after you are once fairly in the midst of your enterprise. They are unavoidable at this moment, standing as you do on the outer verge of your long seclusion, and peopling the world with ugly shapes, which you will soon find to be as unreal as the giants and ogres of a child's storybook. I find nothing so singular in life as that everything appears to lose its substance the instant one actually grapples with it. So it will be with what you think so terrible."
"But I am a woman," said Hepzibah piteously. "I was going to say a lady, but I consider that as past."
"Well, no matter if it be past," answered the artist, a strange gleam of half-hidden sarcasm flashing through the kindliness of his manner. "Let it go. You are the better without it. I speak frankly, my dear Miss Pynchon, for are we not friends? I look upon this as one of the fortunate days of your life. It ends an epoch and begins one. Hitherto the life-blood has been gradually chilling in your veins as you sat aloof within your circle of gentility, while the rest of the world was fighting out its battle with one kind of necessity or another. Henceforth you will at least have the sense of healthy and natural effort for a purpose, and of lending your strength, be it great or small, to the united struggle of mankind. This is success, all the success that anybody meets with."
"It is natural enough, Mr. Holgrave, that you should have ideas like these," rejoined Hepzibah, drawing up her gaunt figure with slightly offended dignity. "You are a man, a young man, and brought up, I suppose, as almost everybody is nowadays, with a view to seeking your fortune. But I was born a lady, and have always lived one, no matter what the narrowness of means, always a lady."
"But I was not born a gentleman. Neither have I lived like one," said Holgrave, slightly smiling. "So, my dear madam, you will hardly expect me to sympathize with sensibilities of this kind, though, unless I deceive myself, I have some imperfect comprehension of them. These names of gentleman and lady had a meaning in the past history of the world, and conferred privileges, desirable or otherwise, on those entitled to bear them. In the present, and still more in the future condition of society, they imply not privilege, but restriction."
"These are new notions," said the old gentlewoman, shaking her head. "I shall never understand them. Neither do I wish it."
"We will cease to speak of them, then," replied the artist, with a friendlier smile than his last one, "and I will leave you to feel whether it is not better to be a true woman than a lady. Do you really think, Miss Hepzibah, that any lady of your family has ever done a more heroic thing since this house was built than you are performing in it today? Never. And if the Pynchons had always acted so nobly, I doubt whether an old Wizard Maul's anathema, of which you told me once, would have had much weight with Providence against them."
"Ah, no, no," said Hepzibah,
not displeased at this allusion to the somber dignity of an inherited curse. "If old Maul's ghost, or a descendant of his, could see me behind the counter today, he would call it the fulfillment of his worst wishes. But I thank you for your kindness, Mr. Holgrave, and will do my utmost to be a good shopkeeper." "Pray do," said Holgrave, "and let me have the pleasure of being your first customer. I am about taking a walk to the seashore before going to my rooms, where I misuse heaven's blessed sunshine by tracing out human features through its agency. A few of those biscuits dipped in seawater will be just what I need for breakfast. What is the price of half a dozen?"
"Let me be a lady a moment longer," replied Hepzibah,
with a manner of antique stateliness to which a melancholy smile lent a kind of grace. She put the biscuits into his hand, but rejected the compensation.
"A Pynchon must not, at all events under her forefather's roof, receive money for a morsel of bread from her only friend."
Holgrave took his departure, leaving her for the moment with spirits not quite so much depressed. Soon, however, they had subsided nearly to their former dead level. With a beating heart she listened to the footsteps of early passengers, which now began to be frequent along the street. Once or twice they seemed to linger. These strangers, or neighbors as the case might be, were looking at the display of toys and petty commodities in Hepzibah's shop window. She was doubly tortured. in part with a sense of overwhelming shame that strange and unloving eyes should have the privilege of gazing, and partly because the idea occurred to her with ridiculous importunity that the window was not arranged so skillfully, nor nearly to so much advantage as it might have been. It seemed as if the whole fortune or failure of her shop might depend on the display of a different set of articles, or substituting a fairer apple for one which appeared to be specked. So she made the change, and straightway fancied that everything was spoiled by it, not recognizing that it was the nervousness of the juncture and her own native squeamishness as an old maid that wrought all the seeming mischief. Anon there was an encounter just at the doorstep betwixt two laboring men, as their rough voices denoted them to be. After some slight talk about their own affairs, one of them chanced to notice the shop window, and directed the other's attention to it. "See here," cried he. "What do you think of this? Trade seems to be looking up in Pynchon Street." "Well, well, this is a sight, to be sure," exclaimed the other. "In the old Pynchon house, and underneath the Pynchon elm, who would have thought it? Old maid Pynchon is setting up a scent shop."
"Will she make it go, think you, Dixie?" said his friend.
"I don't call it a very good stand. There's another shop just round the corner."
"Make it go!"
cried Dixie, with a most contemptuous expression, as if the very idea were impossible to be conceived.
"Not a bit of it. Why, her face! I've seen it, for I dug her garden for her one year. Her face is enough to frighten old Nick himself, if he had ever so great a mind to trade with her. People can't stand it, I tell you. She scowls dreadfully, reason or none, out of pure ugliness of temper."
"Well, that's not so much matter," remarked the other man. "These sour-tempered folks are mostly handy at business and know pretty well what they're about. But as you say, I don't think she'll do much. This business of keeping scent shops is overdone, like all other kinds of trade, handicraft, and bodily labor. I know it to my cost. My wife kept a scent shop 3 months and lost $5 on her outlay."
"Poor business," responded Dixie, in a tone as if he were shaking his head. "Poor business."
For some reason or other, not very easy to analyze, there had hardly been so bitter a pang in all her previous misery about the matter as what thrilled Hepzibah's heart on overhearing the above conversation. The testimony in regard to her scowl was frightfully important. It seemed to hold up her image wholly relieved from the false light of her self-partialities, and so hideous that she dared not look at it. She was absurdly hurt, moreover, by the slight and idle effect that her setting up shop, an event of such breathless interest to herself, appeared to have upon the public, of which these two men were the nearest representatives. A glance, a passing word or two, a coarse laugh, and she was doubtless forgotten before they turned the corner. They cared nothing for her dignity, and just as little for her degradation. Then also the augury of ill success uttered from the sure wisdom of experience fell upon her half-dead hope like a clod into a grave. The man's wife had already tried the same experiment and failed. How could the born lady, the recluse of half a lifetime, utterly unpractised in the world at 60 years of age, how could she ever dream of succeeding, when the hard, vulgar, keen, busy, hackneyed New England woman had lost $5 on her little outlay? Success presented itself as an impossibility, and the hope of it as a wild hallucination. Some malevolent spirit, doing his utmost to drive Hepzibah mad, unrolled before her imagination a kind of panorama representing the great thoroughfare of a city all astir with customers. So many and so magnificent shops as there were, groceries, toy shops, dry goods stores, with their immense panes of plate glass, their gorgeous fixtures, their vast and complete assortments of merchandise, in which fortunes had been invested. And those noble mirrors at the farther end of each establishment, doubling all this wealth by a brightly burnished vista of unrealities. On one side of the street, this splendid bazaar, with a multitude of perfumed and glossy salesmen smirking, smiling, bowing, and measuring out the goods. On the other, the dusky old house of the Seven Gables, with the antiquated shop window under its projecting story, and Hepzibah herself in a gown of rusty black silk behind the counter, scowling at the world as it went by. This mighty contrast thrust itself forward as a fair expression of the odds against which she was to begin her struggle for a subsistence. Success! Preposterous! She would never think of it again. The house might just as well be buried in an eternal fog, while all other houses had the sunshine on them, for not a foot would ever cross the threshold, nor a hand so much as try the door. But at this instant the shop bell right over her head tinkled as if it were bewitched. The old gentlewoman's heart seemed to be attached to the same steel spring, for it went through a series of sharp jerks in unison with the sound. The door was thrust open, although no human form was perceptible on the other side of the half-window. Hepzibah, nevertheless, stood at a gaze, with her hands clasped, looking very much as if she had summoned up an evil spirit and were afraid yet resolved to hazard the encounter. "Heaven help me," she groaned mentally. "Now is my hour of need." The door, which moved with difficulty on its creaking and rusty hinges, being forced quite open, a square and sturdy little urchin became apparent, with cheeks as red as an apple. He was clad rather shabbily, but as it seemed more owing to his mother's carelessness than his father's poverty, in a blue apron, very wide and short trousers, shoes somewhat out at the toes, and a chip hat with the frizzles of his curly hair sticking through its crevices. A book and a small slate under his arm indicated that he was on his way to school. He stared at Hepzibah a moment, as an elder customer than himself would have been likely enough to do, not knowing what to make of the tragic attitude and queer scowl wherewith she regarded him.
"Well, child," said she, taking heart at sight of a personage so little formidable, "well, my child, what did you wish for?" "That Jim Crow there in the window," answered the urchin, holding out a cent and pointing to the gingerbread figure that had attracted his notice as he loitered along to school. "The one that has not a broken foot."
So Hepzibah put forth her lank arm, and taking the effigy from the shop window, delivered it to her first customer.
"No matter for the money," said she, giving him a little push towards the door, for her old gentility was contumaciously squeamish at the sight of the copper coin, and besides it seemed such pitiful meanness to take the child's pocket money in exchange for a bit of stale gingerbread. "No matter for the cent, you are welcome to Jim Crow."
The child, staring with round eyes at this instance of liberality, wholly unprecedented in his large experience of cent shops, took the man of gingerbread and quitted the premises. No sooner had he reached the sidewalk, little cannibal that he was, than Jim Crow's head was in his mouth. As he had not been careful to shut the door, Hepzibah was at the pains of closing it after him, with a pettish ejaculation or two about the troublesomeness of young people, and particularly of small boys. She had just placed another representative of the renowned Jim Crow at the window, when again the shop bell tinkled clamorously, and again the door being thrust open with its characteristic jerk and jar, disclosed the same sturdy little urchin, who precisely 2 minutes ago had made his exit. The crumbs and discoloration of the cannibal feast, as yet hardly consummated, were exceedingly visible about his mouth.
"What is it now, child?" asked the maiden lady, rather impatiently. "Did you come back to shut the door?" "No," answered the urchin, pointing to the figure that had just been put up. "I want that other Jim Crow."
"Well, here it is for you," said Hepzibah, reaching it down. But recognizing that this pertinacious customer would not quit her on any other terms, so long as she had a gingerbread figure in her shop, she partly drew back her extended hand.
"Where is the cent?"
The little boy had the cent ready, but, like a true-born Yankee, would have preferred the better bargain to the worse. Looking somewhat chagrined, he put the coin into Hepzibah's hand and departed, sending the second Jim Crow in quest of the former one. The new shopkeeper dropped the first solid result of her commercial enterprise into the till. It was done. The sordid stain of that copper coin could never be washed away from her palm. The little schoolboy, aided by the impish figure of the negro dancer, had wrought an irreparable ruin. The structure of ancient aristocracy had been demolished by him, even as if his childish gripe had torn down the seven-gabled mansion. Now let Hepzibah turn the old Pynchon portraits with their faces to the wall, and take the map of her eastern territory to kindle the kitchen fire, and blow up the flame with the empty breath of her ancestral traditions. What had she to do with ancestry? Nothing, no more than with posterity. No lady, now, but simply Hepzibah Pynchon, a forlorn old maid and keeper of a scent shop. Nevertheless, even while she paraded these ideas somewhat ostentatiously through her mind, it is altogether surprising what a calmness had come over her. The anxiety and misgivings which had tormented her, whether asleep or in melancholy daydreams, ever since her project began to take an aspect of solidity, had now vanished quite away. She felt the novelty of her position, indeed, but no longer with disturbance or affright. Now and then there came a thrill of almost youthful enjoyment. It was the invigorating breath of a fresh outward atmosphere after the long torpor and monotonous seclusion of her life. So wholesome is effort, so miraculous the strength that we do not know of. The healthiest glow that Hepzibah had known for years had come now in the dreaded crisis, when for the first time she had put forth her hand to help herself. The little circlet of the schoolboy's copper coin, dim and lustreless though it was with the small services which it had been doing here and there about the world, had proved a talisman, fragrant with good, and deserving to be set in gold and worn next to her heart. It was as potent, and perhaps endowed with the same kind of efficacy, as a galvanic ring. Hepzibah, at all events, was indebted to its subtle operation, both in body and spirit. So much the more as it inspired her with energy to get some breakfast, at which, still the better to keep up her courage, she allowed herself an extra spoonful in her infusion of black tea. Her introductory day of shopkeeping did not run on, however, without many and serious interruptions of this mood of cheerful vigor. As a general rule, Providence seldom vouchsafes to mortals any more than just that degree of encouragement which suffices to keep them at a reasonably full exertion of their powers. In the case of our old gentlewoman, after the excitement of new effort had subsided, the despondency of her whole life threatened ever and anon to return. It was like the heavy mass of clouds which we may often see obscuring the sky and making a gray twilight everywhere until, towards nightfall, it yields temporarily to a glimpse of sunshine. But always the envious cloud strives to gather again across the streak of celestial azure. Customers came in as the forenoon advanced, but rather slowly. In some cases, too, it must be owned with little satisfaction, either to themselves or Miss Hepzibah, nor on the whole with an aggregate of very rich emolument to the till. A little girl sent by her mother to match a skein of cotton thread of a peculiar hue took one that the near-sighted old lady pronounced extremely like, but soon came running back with a blunt and cross message that it would not do and besides was very rotten. Then there was a pale, care-wrinkled woman, not old, but haggard, and already with streaks of grey among her hair like silver ribbons. One of those women, naturally delicate, whom you at once recognize as worn to death by a brute, probably a drunken brute of a husband, and at least 9 children. She wanted a few pounds of flour, and offered the money, which the decayed gentlewoman silently rejected, and gave the poor soul better measure than if she had taken it. Shortly afterwards, a man in a blue cotton frock, much soiled, came in and bought a pipe, filling the whole shop, meanwhile, with the hot odor of strong drink, not only exhaled in the torrid atmosphere of his breath, but oozing out of his entire system like an inflammable gas. It was impressed on Hepzibah's mind that this was the husband of the care-wrinkled woman. He asked for a paper of tobacco, and as she had neglected to provide herself with the article, her brutal customer dashed down his newly bought pipe and left the shop, muttering some unintelligible words, which had the tone and bitterness of a curse. Hereupon Hepzibah threw up her eyes, unintentionally scowling in the face of Providence. No less than 5 persons during the forenoon inquired for ginger beer or root beer or any drink of a similar brewage, and obtaining nothing of the kind, went off in an exceedingly bad humor. Three of them left the door open, and the other two pulled it so spitefully in going out that the little bell played the very deuce with Hepzibah's nerves. A round, bustling, fire-ruddy housewife of the neighborhood burst breathless into the shop, fiercely demanding yeast, and when the poor gentlewoman, with her cold shyness of manner, gave her hot customer to understand that she did not keep the article, this very capable housewife took upon herself to administer a regular rebuke.
"A cent shop and no yeast," quoth she. "That will never do. Whoever heard of such a thing? Your loaf will never rise, no more than mine will today. You had better shut up shop at once."
"Well," said Hepzibah, heaving a deep sigh, "perhaps I had."
Several times, moreover, besides the above instance, her ladylike sensibilities were seriously infringed upon by the familiar, if not rude, tone with which people addressed her. They evidently considered themselves not merely her equals, but her patrons and superiors. Now Hepzibah had unconsciously flattered herself with the idea that there would be a gleam or halo of some kind or other about her person which would ensure an obeisance to her sterling gentility, or at least a tacit recognition of it. On the other hand, nothing tortured her more intolerably than when this recognition was too prominently expressed. To one or two rather officious offers of sympathy, her responses were little short of acrimonious, and we regret to say Hepzibah was thrown into a positively unchristian state of mind by the suspicion that one of her customers was drawn to the shop not by any real need of the article which she pretended to seek, but by a wicked wish to stare at her. The vulgar creature was determined to see for herself what sort of a figure a mildewed piece of aristocracy, after wasting all the bloom and much of the decline of her life apart from the world, would cut behind a counter. In this particular case, however mechanical and innocuous it might be at other times, Hepzibah's contortion of brow served her in good stead.
"I never was so frightened in my life," said the curious customer,
in describing the incident to one of her acquaintances.
"She's a real old vixen, take my word for it. She says little, to be sure, but if you could only see the mischief in her eye."
On the whole, therefore, her new experience led our decayed gentlewoman to very disagreeable conclusions as to the temper and manners of what she termed the lower classes, whom heretofore she had looked down upon with a gentle and pitying complacence, as herself occupying a sphere of unquestionable superiority. But, unfortunately, she had likewise to struggle against a bitter emotion of a directly opposite kind, a sentiment of virulence, we mean, towards the idle aristocracy to which it had so recently been her pride to belong. When a lady in a delicate and costly summer garb, with a floating veil and gracefully swaying gown, and altogether an ethereal lightness that made you look at her beautifully slippered feet to see whether she trod on the dust or floated in the air, when such a vision happened to pass through this retired street, leaving it tenderly and delusively fragrant with her passage as if a bouquet of tea-roses had been borne along, then again it is to be feared old Hepzibah's scowl could no longer vindicate itself entirely on the plea of near-sightedness.
"For what end?"
thought she, giving vent to that feeling of hostility which is the only real abasement of the poor in the presence of the rich.
"For what good end, in the wisdom of Providence, does that woman live? Must the whole world toil that the palms of her hands may be kept white and delicate?"
Then, ashamed and penitent, she hid her face.
"May God forgive me," said she.
Doubtless God did forgive her. But taking the inward and outward history of the first half-day into consideration, Hepzibah began to fear that the shop would prove her ruin in a moral and religious point of view, without contributing very essentially towards even her temporal welfare. 4. A Day Behind the Counter. Towards noon, Hepzibah saw an elderly gentleman, large and portly and of remarkably dignified demeanor, passing slowly along on the opposite side of the white and dusty street. On coming within the shadow of the pinion elm, he stopped, and taking off his hat meanwhile to wipe the perspiration from his brow, seemed to scrutinize with especial interest the dilapidated and rusty-visaged House of the Seven Gables. He himself, in a very different style, was as well worth looking at as the house. No better model need be sought, nor could have been found, of a very high order of respectability, which by some indescribable magic not merely expressed itself in his looks and gestures, but even governed the fashion of his garments and rendered them all proper and essential to the man. Without appearing to differ in any tangible way from other people's clothes, there was yet a wide and rich gravity about them that must have been a characteristic of the wearer, since it could not be defined as pertaining either to the cut or material. His gold-headed cane, too, a serviceable staff of dark polished wood, had similar traits, and had it chosen to take a walk by itself, would have been recognized anywhere as a tolerably adequate representative of its master. This character, which showed itself so strikingly in everything about him, and the effect of which we seek to convey to the reader, went no deeper than his station, habits of life, and external circumstances. One perceived him to be a personage of marked influence and authority, and especially you could feel just as certain that he was opulent, as if he had exhibited his bank account, or as if you had seen him touching the twigs of the pinchon elm and Midas-like transmuting them to gold. In his youth he had probably been considered a handsome man. At his present age his brow was too heavy, his temples too bare, his remaining hair too gray, his eye too cold, his lips too closely compressed, to bear any relation to mere personal beauty. He would have made a good and massive portrait, better now, perhaps, than at any previous period of his life, although his look might grow positively harsh in the process of being fixed upon the canvas. The artist would have found it desirable to study his face and prove its capacity for varied expression, to darken it with a frown, to kindle it up with a smile. While the elderly gentleman stood looking at the pinchon house, both the frown and the smile passed successively over his countenance. His eye rested on the shop window, and putting up a pair of gold-bowed spectacles, which he held in his hand, he minutely surveyed Hepzibah's little arrangement of toys and commodities. At first it seemed not to please him, nay, to cause him exceeding displeasure, and yet the very next moment he smiled. While the latter expression was yet on his lips, he caught a glimpse of Hepzibah, who had involuntarily bent forward to the window, and then the smile changed from acrid and disagreeable to the sunniest complacency and benevolence. He bowed with a happy mixture of dignity and courteous kindliness, and pursued his way. "There he is," said Hepzibah to herself, gulping down a very bitter emotion, and since she could not rid herself of it, trying to drive it back into her heart. "What does he think of it, I wonder? Does it please him? He's looking back." The gentleman had paused in the street and turned himself half about, still with his eyes fixed on the shop window. In fact, he wheeled wholly round and commenced a step or two as if designing to enter the shop. But as it chanced, his purpose was anticipated by Hepzibah's first customer, the little cannibal of Jim Crow, who, staring up at the window, was irresistibly attracted by an elephant of gingerbread. What a grand appetite had this small urchin! 2 Jim Crows immediately after breakfast, and now an elephant as a preliminary whet before dinner. By the time this latter purchase was completed, the elderly gentleman had resumed his way and turned the street corner.
"Take it as you like, Cousin Jaffrey,"
muttered the maiden lady as she drew back after cautiously thrusting out her head and looking up and down the street.
"Take it as you like. You have seen my little shop window. Well, what have you to say? Is not the pinchon house my own while I'm alive?"
After this incident, Hepzibah retreated to the back parlor, where she at first caught up a half-finished stocking and began knitting at it with nervous and irregular jerks. But quickly finding herself at odds with the stitches, she threw it aside and walked hurriedly about the room. At length she paused before the portrait of the stern old Puritan, her ancestor and the founder of the house. In one sense, this picture had almost faded into the canvas and hidden itself behind the duskiness of age. In another, she could not but fancy that it had been growing more prominent and strikingly expressive ever since her earliest familiarity with it as a child. For while the physical outline and substance were darkening away from the beholder's eye, the bold, hard, and at the same time indirect character of the man seemed to be brought out in a kind of spiritual relief. Such an effect may occasionally be observed in pictures of antique date. They acquire a look which an artist, if he have anything like the complacency of artists nowadays, would never dream of presenting to a patron as his own characteristic expression, but which nevertheless we at once recognize as reflecting the unlovely truth of a human soul. In such cases, the painter's deep conception of his subject's inward traits has wrought itself into the essence of the picture, and is seen after the superficial coloring has been rubbed off by time. While gazing at the portrait, Hepzibah trembled under its eye. Her hereditary reverence made her afraid to judge the character of the original so harshly as a perception of the truth compelled her to do, but still she gazed, because the face of the picture enabled her, at least she fancied so, to read more accurately and to a greater depth the face which she had just seen in the street.
"This is the very man,"
murmured she to herself.
"Let Jaffrey pinch and smile as he will. There's that look beneath. Put on him a skull-cap and a band, and a black coat, and a Bible in one hand, and a sword in the other. Then let Jaffrey smile as he might. Nobody would doubt that it was the old Pynchon come again. He has proved himself the very man to build up a new house, perhaps, too, to draw down a new curse."
Thus did Hepzibah bewilder herself with these fantasies of the old time. She had dwelt too much alone, too long in the Pynchon house, until her very brain was impregnated with the dry rot of its timbers. She needed a walk along the noonday street to keep her sane. By the spell of contrast, another portrait rose up before her, painted with more daring flattery than any artist would have ventured upon, but yet so delicately touched that the likeness remained perfect. Malbone's miniature, though from the same original, was far inferior to Hepzibah's air-drawn picture, at which affection and sorrowful remembrance wrought together. Soft, mildly and cheerfully contemplative, with full red lips just on the verge of a smile, which the eyes seemed to herald by a gentle kindling up of their orbs. Feminine traits, molded inseparably with those of the other sex. The miniature likewise had this last peculiarity, so that you inevitably thought of the original as resembling his mother, and she a lovely and lovable woman, with perhaps some beautiful infirmity of character that made it all the pleasanter to know and easier to love her. Yes, thought Hepzibah, with grief of which it was only the more tolerable portion that welled up from her heart to her eyelids. They persecuted his mother in him. He never was a Pynchon. But here the shop bell rang. It was like a sound from a remote distance, so far had Hepzibah descended into the sepulchral depths of her reminiscences. On entering the shop, she found an old man there, a humble resident of Pynchon Street, and whom, for a great many years past, she had suffered to be a kind of familiar of the house. He was an immemorial personage, who seemed always to have had a white head and wrinkles, and never to have possessed but a single tooth, and that a half-decayed one in the front of the upper jaw. Well advanced as Hepzibah was, she could not remember when Uncle Venner, as the neighborhood called him, had not gone up and down the street, stooping a little and drawing his feet heavily over the gravel or pavement. But still there was something tough and vigorous about him that not only kept him in daily breath, but enabled him to fill a place which would else have been vacant in the apparently crowded world. To go of errands with his slow and shuffling gait, which made you doubt how he ever was to arrive anywhere, to saw a small household's foot or two of firewood, or knock to pieces an old barrel, or split up a pine board for kindling stuff, in summer to dig the few yards of garden ground appertaining to a low-rented tenement and share the produce of his labor at the halves, in winter to shovel away the snow from the sidewalk or open paths to the woodshed or along the clothesline, such were some of the essential offices which Uncle Venner performed among at least a score of families. Within that circle he claimed the same sort of privilege and probably felt as much warmth of interest as a clergyman does in the range of his parishioners. Not that he laid claim to the tithe pig, but as an analogous mode of reverence he went his rounds every morning to gather up the crumbs of the table and overflowings of the dinner pot as food for a pig of his own. In his younger days, for after all there was a dim tradition that he had been, not young but younger, Uncle Venner was commonly regarded as rather deficient than otherwise in his wits. In truth, he had virtually pleaded guilty to the charge by scarcely aiming at such success as other men seek, and by taking only that humble and modest part in the intercourse of life which belongs to the alleged deficiency. But now, in his extreme old age, whether it were that his long and hard experience had actually brightened him, or that his decaying judgment rendered him less capable of fairly measuring himself, the venerable man made pretensions to no little wisdom, and really enjoyed the credit of it. There was, likewise at times, a vein of something like poetry in him. It was the moss or wallflower of his mind in its small dilapidation, and gave a charm to what might have been vulgar and commonplace in his earlier and middle life. Hepzibah had a regard for him because his name was ancient in the town and had formerly been respectable. It was a still better reason for awarding him a species of familiar reverence that Uncle Venner was himself the most ancient existence, whether of man or thing, in Pynchon Street, except the House of the Seven Gables, and perhaps the elm that overshadowed it. This patriarch now presented himself before Hepzibah, clad in an old blue coat, which had a fashionable air and must have accrued to him from the cast-off wardrobe of some dashing clerk. As for his trousers, they were of tow-cloth, very short in the legs, and bagging down strangely in the rear, but yet having a suitableness to his figure, which his other garment entirely lacked. His hat had relation to no other part of his dress, and but very little to the head that wore it. Thus Uncle Venner was a miscellaneous old gentleman, partly himself but in good measure somebody else, patched together two of different epochs, an epitome of times and fashions.
"So you have really begun trade," said he, "really begun trade. Well, I'm glad to see it. Young people should never live idle in the world, nor old ones neither, unless when the rheumatize gets hold of them. It has given me warning already, and in 2 or 3 years longer I shall think of putting aside business and retiring to my farm. That's yonder, the great brick house, you know, the workhouse, most folks call it. But I mean to do my work first, and go there to be idle and enjoy myself. And I'm glad to see you beginning to do your work, Miss Hepzibah."
"Thank you, Uncle Venner," said Hepzibah, smiling,
for she had always felt kindly towards the simple and talkative old man. Had he been an old woman, she might probably have repelled the freedom, which she now took in good part.
"It is time for me to begin work, indeed. Or, to speak the truth, I have just begun when I ought to be giving it up."
"Oh, never say that, Miss Hepzibah," answered the old man. "You are a young woman yet. Why, I hardly thought myself younger than I am now. It seems so little while ago since I used to see you playing about the door of the old house quite a small child. Oftener, though, you used to be sitting at the threshold and looking gravely into the street, for you had always a grave kind of way with you, a grown-up air, when you were only the height of my knee. It seems as if I saw you now, and your grandfather, with his red cloak and his white wig and his cocked hat and his cane, coming out of the house and stepping so grandly up the street. Those old gentlemen that grew up before the Revolution used to put on grand airs. In my young days, the great man of the town was commonly called King, and his wife, not Queen, to be sure, but Lady. Nowadays a man would not dare to be called King, and if he feels himself a little above common folks, he only stoops so much the lower to them. I met your cousin, the judge, 10 minutes ago. And in my old tow-cloth trousers, as you see, the judge raised his hat to me, I do believe. At any rate, the judge bowed and smiled."
"Yes,"
said Hepzibah, with something bitter stealing unawares into her tone. "My cousin Geoffrey is thought to have a very pleasant smile."
"And so he has," replied Uncle Venner. "And that's rather remarkable in a pinch. For begging your pardon, Miss Hepzibah, they never had the name of being an easy and agreeable set of folks. There was no getting close to them. But now, Miss Hepzibah, if an old man may be bold to ask, why don't Judge Pynchon, with his great means, step forward and tell his cousin to shut up her little shop at once? It's for your credit to be doing something, but it's not for the judge's credit to let you."
"We won't talk of this, if you please, Uncle Venner," said Hepzibah coldly. "I ought to say, however, that if I choose to earn bread for myself, it is not Judge Pynchon's fault. Neither will he deserve the blame," added she, more kindly, remembering Uncle Venner's privileges of age and humble familiarity, "if I should, by and by, find it convenient to retire with you to your farm."
"And it's no bad place either, that farm of mine," cried the old man cheerily, as if there were something positively delightful in the prospect. "No bad place is the great brick farmhouse, especially for them that will find a good many old cronies there, as will be my case. I quite long to be among them sometimes of the winter evenings, for it is but dull business for a lonesome elderly man like me to be nodding by the hour together with no company but his airtight stove. Summer or winter, there's a great deal to be said in favour of my farm. And take it in the autumn, what can be pleasanter than to spend a whole day on the sunny side of a barn or a woodpile chatting with somebody as old as oneself, or perhaps idling away the time with a natural-born simpleton who knows how to be idle, because even our busy Yankees never have found out how to put him to any use. Upon my word, Miss Hepzibah, I doubt whether I've ever been so comfortable as I mean to be at my farm, which most folks call the workhouse. But you're a young woman yet. You'll never need to go there. Something still better will turn up for you, I'm sure of it."
Hepzibah fancied that there was something